spoken of this topic to bootstrap modularized basics. And more precisely, I would be asking the question, how does the existence of a modularized base constrain CFD data? There's also a related question, which is, let's say I give you all CFD data on the coefficient of non-dimensions, can you tell me whether the CFD has a modular space? How do you tell me the CFD has a modular space? And to be clear, by modular space, I don't mean a conformal manifold, I mean a modular space. So I'm going to split the talk into two parts. In part one, I'm going to assume a CFD of a modular space, and an additional assume an additional U1 symmetry, which is broken. Spontaneously broken. Along the modular space. Here we're going to say some very precise things and have some nice results. And then, if I have time in the second part, I'm going to talk about the generic case with no additional assumptions. If you want symmetries and still get some constraints and some perturbative sum rules, if you data, just using the fact that I have okay, so let's try to look at this question in the most famous case in which I have modular spaces. So, modular spaces require a lot of fine tuning, they require flat direction in your potential. Usually that requires a lot of symmetry, and the only cases we know that have this is cases with supersymmetry. And the most famous cases are either three-dimensional or n=3.
Right, so the most famous cases we know with moduli spaces are either 3d n equals 2 supersymmetry or 4d n equals 1 supersymmetry or higher, and both of these have four supercharges. So with this amount of supersymmetry, there are some very precise answers to this question. So specifically, there is a general conjecture for these kinds of theories, which says that the moduli space is isomorphic to something called the chiral ring. And without going into details about what this means, there's some immediate corollaries. So the first corollary is that these theories always in a CFT, an SCFT, with four supercharges, you always have an R symmetry, a U1R symmetry at least. And this conjecture tells you that it is spontaneously broken on the moduli space. So immediately,
yeah.
Of vacua, not conformal manifold. Yes, moduli space of vacua, not conformal manifold.
This was a spectrum of the liquid.
I'm sorry?
I want to say have a spectrum of the liquid.
Sure. Yes. So this conjecture immediately tells you that the U1R symmetry is broken on the moduli space spontaneously, and so we are always in one here. So this is part of the reason why I'm going to put so much emphasis on this. Another corollary is that schematically what this is telling us is that there's a mapping between directions on the moduli space and chiral operators. X such that the dimension of x to the n is n times the dimension of x. So this is just the usual BPS condition for operators which are charged under the U1R symmetry, but the moduli space tells us this is true for any n. Yeah, sorry, let me write this. Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me write it up here. Yeah. So moduli spaces with four supercharges schematically give us this relation for some operator x to the n. Okay, so this is a very precise answer to what types of constraints we have on.
Why is this not automatic?
Automatic, I mean, in a non-supersymmetric theory, it's not, but with four supercharges. So otherwise, I just don't have even the concept of a chiral ring. So let me ask it differently. Is this relation a consequence of a moduli space or of supersymmetry?
It's
Because something this precise seems like you need supersymmetry to have it.
So when you say chi, do you mean chi in the safety sense, meaning dimensionally equal?
No, I mean BPS operators. BPS operators, yes, it's this is equal to, right, to the R charge of X.
Okay. So that charge is good.
I mean,
so.
No, okay, but X to the N doesn't have to be chiral itself.
Okay.
If you have F terms, so let me do an example.
Sure.
So the example I'm going to focus on 3D and this stuff. So 3D equals 2, I'm going to do the XYZ model. So this consists of three chiral superfields with superpotential X times Y times Z. So let's compute the moduli space for this theory. Classically, to do it, what I do is I solve the F term equations. These are basically just the equations of motion. The F-terms equations are that dw dx, dw dy, and dw dz all have to vanish. So this is just xy equals yz equals xz equals 0. And so the solution to the equations are either x is not 0, or y gets a vev, or z gets a vev. So this theory has three branches for its moduli space, where one of the chiral superfields gets a vev.
In this example, X to the N is chiral.
Right. Because of the moduli space, then in this example, the dimension of X to the N is N times the dimension of X, but it's because of the moduli space. So usually the way to get rid of a moduli space is that the F-term equations give you something non-trivial. And then, for example, let's take just W equals X to the N, X to the K. So now X to the K minus 1 is no longer chiral. Right, so the F-term equation set.
But when you have the equation that x to the n equal to essentially a charge of x to the n,
mm-hmm.
then implies it's chiral, right?
Sure. Okay. So the statement is that x to the n is always chiral.
Just x. Okay.
This is for me, it's going to be equivalent. Yes. Yes. I'm focusing on this statement because eventually I want to remove some supercharges, and then saying x to the n is no longer chiral doesn't make sense because I'm not going to have chiral superfields anymore. Sure. Yes. So I'm also going to need. Good. I'm going to change this in a sec. Good. Okay. Good. And in this specific case, it's even better because, like David said, this is just n times the R charge of x, which is 2/3. So the dimension of x to the n is just 2/3 n.
Can you explain more about the specs of that model, which is W here?
W is the superpotential.
Yes,
so this is just some notation. In terms of a non-supersymmetric theory, just the usual potential, x, y, and z consist of x has a scalar and a fermion, and y has a scalar and a fermion, and so does z.
Yeah.
So from this, I read off the potential as being sum over all of the fields, d phi w squared plus w psi squared. So for this specific model, this term just gives me xy squared plus yz squared plus xz squared. This is the potential, just forgetting about supersymmetry, for this model, and there's also couplings to fermions. So this is just notation that's telling me what the actual potential looks like. Okay, so this statement now gives us some idea for an answer to this question. So what we would have wanted to say is that a moduli space gives us a tower of operators, whatever that means, such that this is true. But again, like David just said, this operator really needs to be defined before you write down this equation. So I'm going to write down a different version of the statement. Let's define an observable delta min of Q, where Q is a charge for some U1 symmetry. And I define it to be the minimal dimension of all operators of charge Q. So the picture you should have in mind is that we have some CFT, and I can draw the spectrum as a function of charge and dimension. So at zero charge and zero dimension, I just have the identity. And then I have neutral operators. And at charge one, I have some operator, and then operators above it, charge two, so on. And so I connect all of the lowest dimension operators, and I call this line delta min of q. So now this observable makes sense in any CFT. I don't need supersymmetry, I don't need anything else, and this observable just makes sense. And so our idea is now that a moduli space tells us that delta min of q is exactly linear in q. So at least for the supersymmetric examples, this is true. And we'd like to ask if this is more general. So I want to emphasize that.
Supersymmetric example.
I mean, you know the answer is no. Okay, non-supersymmetric. Let's take two supercharges instead of four, and then we can ask this question. So that's going to be the next step. Non-supersymmetric, you have to start doing a large N or some weird tricks, and I'm going to try not to talk about that. But even with two supercharges, this would be a very surprising result if this was true. Okay, let me emphasize that this is very non-trivial. This observable has been studied a lot in the context of the large charge expansion. And what they do is they look at it at q equals infinity, or q, sorry, at very large q, and they find two types of behaviors in general. Behavior number one is what I'm going to call a generic CFT with no moduli space, where delta min of q behaves like q to the d over d minus 1, where d is your space-time dimension. And the second behavior is this type of behavior. I'm going to call this either the free theory or a VPS or a chiral theory, where delta min of q is exactly q. So the only exception to the generic behavior that's known is this type of behavior. So this is very non-generic and that's a surprising behavior.
Okay. Question. So is the main reason we're concerned with the dependence of delta on q because it allows us to characterize the type of CFT, or is there something more that we important reason to care about this particular dependence?
Sure. I mean, what I'm looking for is just any indication that my theory has a moduli space.
Okay.
So this tells us that this behavior is that indication, at least in theories with enough supersymmetry.
I see. Okay. So the statement that it's linear in Q is the indication that it has a moduli space.
Yes, that immediately should flash some lights and tell you that, okay, something here is special. And the opposite is also true. So if you have a moduli space, then with enough supersymmetry, this behavior has to show up.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, this in the lecture is partial to the sort of fluid dynamic.
Yeah.
How does this free mm-hmm.
Yes. Right. So the idea is you have this superfluid description here. When you get to superfluid, you have to take some very specific limit in the size of the cylinder, right? So what they do is they write down general action for a Goldstone boson, which is Whale invariant. That's how you get this type of thing. And then put it on the cylinder. Now you find its ground state energy. And that ground state energy, due to the state average correspondence, gives you the delta min. What they need is to take the cylinder to scale somehow with the charge. And when there's a moduli space, that scaling doesn't make sense because there's another parameter, which is just the size of the moduli space. So that wins, and the EFT that you write down doesn't correctly describe your theory. I don't think that part is important. I'm going to repeat this analysis, and even without assuming any supersymmetry, you just get a completely different result.
Can I ask a trolley question? Sorry, I have that large.
We don't know if any CFT is above 60. People have tried doing this question because then these things agree, right? So what, I mean, okay, a very stupid idea is that maybe all theories are free at large D because of this relation, but I have no way of making this. I mean, I've thought about it, I'd have no way of making this precise. But yeah, you can maybe try to use this to argue that there's no interacting CFTs at large D.
What is Q for an unsupersymmetric?
It's any U1 symmetry that is broken on the moduli space. Right, so for our theories, these are always R symmetries, but that doesn't have to be the case. Okay, so we've shown this for theories with at least four supercharges, and now we want to ask this question more generally, but first we have to convince people that there are moduli spaces with less than four supercharges. So let me turn to that. So I'm going to discuss 3D n equals 1 theories. And this discussion is going to be following this paper by Gayoto, Wu, and Komogotsky. Okay, so 3D n equals 1 has two supercharges. And this amount of supersymmetry is very, very, very weak. So all of the power of supersymmetry we have in 4D n equals 1, for example, where you have protected operators, you have non-renormalization theorems, and so on, just doesn't apply here. So the lore used to be that these theories are just as hard as non-supersymmetric theories. There's nothing you can actually compute. But it turns out that there is still some amount of symmetry that allows for exact moduli spaces, even with this very weak supersymmetry. So let me just introduce these types of theories. So the types of multiplets you have are a scalar multiplet, which has just a real boson and a Majorana fermion. You have a gauge multiplet, which has a Majorana Gaugino and a gauge field, and so on. And I want to emphasize that the scalar multiplet is real. The fact that the boson here is real also tells us that generically we would not have a U1R symmetry. So these theories, unlike the ones with more supersymmetry, don't have this U1R symmetry, and so don't have these protected operators. A generic Lagrangian for these theories, at least in superspace, consists of a Kähler potential and a superpotential. So you should think of this as a kinetic term and this as an interacting term. Again, with more supercharges, these two terms are very different. For example, in 3D n equals 2, the Kähler potential is integrated over all of superspace, while the superpotential is only integrated over half of superspace. With two superchargers, we cannot integrate over half of superspace, and so this distinction just vanishes. And again, that means that we don't have non-renormalization theorems, and all of the power supersymmetry is, again, just missing. A really simple example for a theory would be, for example, just a single scalar superfield with some kinetic term plus some mass term plus some interaction term. So this is my interaction, my superpotential, and this is going to be my Kähler potential. Okay, so let me try to argue now that even though these theories have minimal supersymmetry and are very weak, they still have exact moduli spaces in some cases. So my example is going to be the ABC model. So this consists of three scalar multiplets, A, B, and C, with superpotential, which looks like A times B times C. So very similar to that XYZ model we had before, except that these are real now, so there's no U1R symmetry. So let's compute what the moduli space is classically. So again, we have the F-term equations, which tell us that these equations have to be obeyed, and so we have a moduli space, at least classically, where either A is non-zero, or B is non-zero, or C is non-zero. Good. So classically, we have a moduli space, but to get moduli spaces classically is very easy. What we need to make sure is that quantum corrections don't lift this moduli space. So to do that, I'm going to compute the effective action, the quantum effective action for this theory. So a general term in quantum effective action is just going to be some polynomial, d2 theta, some polynomial of A, B, and C. And again, generically, you would expect this to just lift the moduli space. However, we have symmetries which constrain what this thing looks like. So even though we don't have a U1R symmetry, it turns out we still have a Z2R symmetry, a discrete one. And what this does is it takes d2 theta to minus d2 theta. That's why I call it an R symmetry. And also A to minus A. Right? So this superpotential, if I write it in superspace, this is my interaction term. If I take this to minus itself and this to minus itself, then this is clearly invariant. So this symmetry also has to be obeyed in the effective action, and so it constrains any term in the effective superpotential to have at least one factor of A, and then a polynomial in A squared, B, and C. But now I can repeat the same argument by taking the Z2R symmetry to take D2 theta to minus D2 theta, but instead take B to minus B. And so repeating the argument, I have to have A, but also have B, with this being B squared here, and then repeating this once more where c goes to minus c, tells me that I have to have a, b, c, and this is just some polynomial in a squared, b squared, and c squared. So this is now the most general term that can appear in the vector superpotential. And now you can just check the F-term equations and show that this always preserves the moduli space. So setting a non-zero with the other two to zero always solves the F-term equations for this general term. So surprisingly, the Z2R symmetry is enough to give me an exact moduli space to all orders in quantum corrections. OK, so now we're very happy because now we can check this result in cases without a U1R symmetry with no protected operators and really distinguish if this is a result of supersymmetry or of a moduli space. So what I want to do now is compute delta min of q. And my only assumption is going to be that there's a moduli space. I'm not going to assume any supersymmetry at all. So I'm going to use the method that the large charge people like to use. So there's going to be three steps. Step number one is I'm going to write down the effective action. The moduli space, which is going to be valid for large VEV. Then I'm going to take this effective action and put it on the cylinder and compute the lowest energy state at charge Q. So the ground state energy at large Q for fixed Q. And finally, since I have a CFT, then the state operator correspondence tells me that this ground state energy on the cylinder just corresponds to this delta min. The ground state energy by the state operator correspondence relates this ground state energy to delta min of Q. OK, so this method has been used over and over in this large charge community. I'm going to mention a specific paper which is very relevant. So these guys did this calculation, but with four supercharges. So you expect this exact relation between delta min and Q. OK, so let's start with step number one. So I need to write the EFT, assuming I give some operator large VEV. So first point I want to make is that even though the EFT is an expansion in the VEV of the operators, since I have a CFT, there's no other scale. And so I can expand in any scale for parameter. So my expansion is going to be in derivatives. But this is completely equivalent to expanding at large VEV. And the second comment is that there are symmetries which very severely constrain what the EFT looks like. So symmetries. So the massless degrees of freedom I expect on this moduli space are a dilaton, just because I'm spontaneously breaking conformal symmetry. This is always there when you have a moduli space, plus an additional Goldstone boson, Nambu Goldstone boson pi, because I'm assuming that I've also broken some U1 symmetry. So now the symmetries are clear. One symmetry is just translations in the Goldstone boson. So this is the nonlinear action of the spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. But there's another symmetry, which is just Weyl transformations, which even though I've broken conformal symmetry spontaneously, it should still act on the dilaton nonlinearly. So the other symmetry is Weyl transformations. And in general, it's pretty hard to write down terms which are Weyl invariant, but there's a nice trick to get this to work. So this is very easy, right? To write down terms that are invariant under this transformation, all I do is always attach a derivative to the Goldstone boson. So this is clearly invariant under this. And so all I have to do is just work with this instead of pi on itself. To get Weyl invariant terms, I'm going to use the following trick. So my degrees of freedom are a dilaton, a the Goldstone boson, and now I'm going to assume that I'm working on some non-trivial metric, so I have these degrees of freedom. A Weyl transformation takes the dilaton to e to the minus 1/2 sigma phi, where I've assumed that the dilaton has dimension 1/2, just because I'm going to work in 3D, so this is the dimension of a free field in 3D. While it takes g mu nu to e to the 2 sigma g mu nu. So now what I can do is take a Weyl transformation such that this thing together just equals 1. So I'm just basically throwing away the dilaton. So after this Weyl transformation, phi is going to just vanish, while g mu nu is going to turn into g mu nu hat, which is g mu nu times phi to the 4th. So after a Weyl transformation, I've turned my original degrees of freedom into a simpler set, which is just the Goldstone boson and this hatted metric. So now I can just write down an EFT for these degrees of freedom, which is diff invariant and invariant under the U1 symmetry. And at the end, I transform back to these other degrees of freedom just by this simple equation, and I will get a Weyl invariant action. OK, so now we can start writing down the EFT. So like we said, it's going to be an expansion derivative. So the leading term is just going to have no derivatives, d to the 0. And there's only one term I can write down, which is the cosmological constant. So this is just some number, and this is just this hatted metric. If I transform back to the original variables using this equation, this gives me integral. This is d3x, d3x, square root of minus g, phi to the 6. So what this term is doing is it's giving my dilaton a potential. So it's lifting my moduli space. And so I'm not allowing this term to show up. So the fact that I'm assuming it is a moduli space, that just means that I'm throwing out this term. I'm assuming there's some supersymmetry or something, which has to set lambda to 0. So the moduli space just removes this term. So the leading term is going to be a two derivative term. There's going to be two terms we can write down. It's basically going to be kinetic terms for these two fields. So one term is just a kinetic term. I can have d mu pi, d nu pi times g hat mu nu. And I can have a Einstein-Hilbert term. So this is the Ricci scalar that I write down using g hat and not the original metric. Writing this in terms of the original degrees of freedom again, what I find is a kinetic term for the Goldstone boson. So I have d pi squared pi squared plus a conformally coupled scalar, which is just a dilaton. So two derivatives, we just have kinetic terms, which are exactly what you'd expect. We have a conformally coupled scalar and just kinetic term for the Goldstone boson. And now you can keep playing this game at four derivatives and six derivatives and so on. But for us, this two derivative action is going to be more than enough. OK, so now let's do step two. And we're going to put this theory on the cylinder, which is very easy because we already worked in some generic metrics. So that just means plugging in what R is for the cylinder. And now we need to find the lowest energy state for fixed charge, the ground state energy at a fixed charge on the cylinder. So what this means is just solving the equations of motion and finding a state with fixed charge that has the lowest ground state energy. And the large charge people already basically tell us the answer to this. So there is something called the helical solution, which gives the dilaton some constant value and gives the Goldstone boson a value that depends on time. So this is already a very non-trivial solution, but it's proven itself over and over in this large charge context. For us, we're just going to assume that this is the lowest energy solution. We can compute both its energy and its charge. So first of all, just plugging this into the equation of motion fixes mu. Mu is going to be something like 1/2, so we can ignore that. And now we can compute the charge of the solution and its energy. So let's start with the charge. Netto's theorem just tells us what the current is. This is the usual thing, the Lagrangian d mu pi, which is phi squared d mu pi. And from this, I can read off the charge density, which is just phi squared times d0 pi, which is basically v squared. So I've just plugged in the solution here. So the charge is just proportional to v squared. Next, I can compute the energy. So what I really need to do is take this, and then from the Lagrangian, I need to get the Hamiltonian and plug in the solution. But we can already see the schematic behavior. So this term in the Hamiltonian is also going to look like r phi squared. So schematically, the energy goes like phi squared, which is v squared. Together, if you do this carefully, what you really find is that the ground state energy is linear, is some number times the charge. OK. So it looks like, just assuming a moduli space, we're close to getting the result we want. But we have only looked at the second order in derivatives effective action. There's many, many corrections. So now we have to ask what the corrections give us. So we found that to order derivative squared in effective action, delta min of q is indeed linear. Now let's ask what happens at four derivative order. So I'm not going to do this explicitly, but we can just use dimensional analysis to fix this. So any term in the effective action has to have four derivatives, and it has to have phi to the minus 2, because the overall dimension has to be 3. Plugging in the solution, what this gives me is phi to the minus 2, which is 1 over the charge. So a higher order derivative will give me a 1 over q correction. B to the 6, you can do the same thing, as you're going to get 1 over q cubed, and so on. So at least higher derivative corrections tell us that indeed the leading term is still linear in Q, but there's going to be corrections. So a moduli space doesn't tell you this exact relation, but it tells you that asymptotically at large charge, you're going to get this exact relation, but it's going to come with some corrections. Let me also mention another type of corrections, which are quantum corrections. So when I compute the ground state energy, I should really also be computing the one loop and two loop corrections around the saddle point. I'm not going to do this carefully, but this gives you corrections which look like q to the 0, 1 over q, 1 over q squared, and so on. So the final result is an expansion in q, where you have this plus 1 over q, 1 over q squared. So not assuming any supersymmetry or anything else, just assuming you have a U1 symmetry on the moduli space, the moduli space tells you that delta min of q takes this specific form.
So you're not
saying what the coefficients of the action? Oh, I haven't fixed them. I'm sorry. There should be some number here that is a relative, so this is the relative coefficient, and that basically fixes this coefficient alpha. Yes. So if you know this number, you can also fix the coefficient there. Yeah, sorry, I was just being sloppy.
In the expansion, I remember one of the coefficients was universal.
Right. So the same thing is true here.
Yeah.
It's the Casimir energy. So this leading correction is the one loop correction to the ground state energy, which is also called the Casimir energy. So what people mean by universal is just that it's fixed by the number of degrees of freedom you have. So the Goldstone bosons and the Dirac-Tan. The same thing is going to be true here. So let me mention that. So this one loop Casimir energy, the interesting thing is that it's completely fixed by our two derivative action. So just because I've told you I have one Goldstone boson and one Dirac-Tan, then just by knowing this effective action, I also know the Casimir energy. So this is very nice because it means that both of these terms are completely fixed at two derivative order. So if I want to know just the first subleading term, all I need is this two derivative order, and I don't care about higher derivative terms. And I'm going to be using this. Let me make also a comment about higher dimensions. So we did this whole thing in 4D, but you can repeat the same analysis. We did this thing in 3D. You can repeat this for 4D. It's going to look very similar. So still, the leading term is going to be linear. The Casimir energy is now going to look like log q. And then you have subleading corrections. So still the important point is that both of these, like the first subleading term, is still just determined by the two derivative action, because it's still just the Casimir energy. OK, good. Any more questions? OK. So what we've shown is that just assuming a multi space, you don't get the linear relation, you also get corrections, but we know that we don't have moduli spaces without at least some supersymmetry, and it's completely possible that supersymmetry still sets these to zero. So what I want to do now is compute some of the corrections explicitly in some theories and see whether they vanish or not. So in explicit examples, do we have this expansion, or do we just have the relation we would have for 3D n equals 2 with a lot of supersymmetry? OK, so example number one is going to be 3D n equals 1 SQED. So this consists of a gauge multiplet, so a gauge field and a gauge geno, plus NF matter multiplets. I'm going to have complex scalars, phi I, and Dirac fermions, psi I. I is 1, 2, so NF. The Lagrangian is going to have kinetic terms for all of these fields, plus a coupling which looks like psi I bar, phi I lambda, plus a complex conjugate. So this is just QED with another fermion coupled to it so that we get supersymmetry. So let's ask if this theory has a moduli space. So clearly, classically, it has a moduli space because there's no potential for the scalars. So I can give any VEV I want to any one of the scalars, and this is completely fine. And now we can argue that quantum corrections also don't lift this moduli space. The reason is that if I write down any superpotential, so in principle, the superpotential is some function of these Kao superfields phi I. But to preserve gauge invariance, this has to be a function of phi I squared. And it's just impossible to write down any superpotential, which is a function of phi squared, which is odd under any transformation, right? So under the Z2R symmetry, this goes to minus itself, but this cannot go to minus itself under any transformation. So I cannot get any superpotential from quantum corrections, and so this moduli space is exact. So my moduli space just corresponds to giving any VEV to these scalars. OK, let's say what else we know about this moduli space. So what is its dimension? So I can give any VEV to the scalars. I have NF complex scalars. So that gives me 2 NF real degrees of freedom. But the gauge symmetry, the U1 symmetry, removes one overall phase. And so I have 2 NF minus 1 degrees of freedom. So this is the dimension of the moduli space. And the massless degrees of freedom that I expect are 1 dilaton. Just from breaking conformal symmetry, but I also expect Goldstone bosons corresponding to breaking of the SUNF symmetry to S of UNF minus 1 times U1 along the moduli space. So my Goldstone bosons parameterize what's called the CPNF model, which is SUNF over S of UNF minus 1 times U1. So let's count degrees of freedom. This gives me 1. This gives me 2 NF minus 1 degrees of freedom. And so together, the dilaton plus Goldstone bosons give me 2 NF minus 1 degrees of freedom. And so these are all of the degrees of freedom I have on my moduli space. So what we've learned is that these together, this plus this, are the degrees of freedom on my moduli space, and I don't have any additional massless degrees of freedom. So now we can start doing computations. So we want the two derivative effective action for these fields. So for the dilaton, it's very simple. It's what we had before. It's just a conformally coupled scalar. Now I need the two derivative action for the Goldstone bosons. So this is 2c phi squared, and then gamma j dci dcj bar. So what I've written down here is a CPNF minus 1 nonlinear sigma model. I've changed coordinates to these z's. So z, I are complex coordinates. I is 1, 2, NF minus 1. And gamma ij is called the Fubini-Studi metric. And it's just a convenient metric for this CPNF. Good, so we have the two derivative action, and now we can compute the ground state energy at some fixed charge on the cylinder. So we write down our helical solution. Phi is just going to be some constant. And we're going to choose a specific U1 symmetry. So there's many isometries to this space. I'm going to choose the isometry which just acts on Z1 by phase. Sorry. So a solution of fixed charge under the symmetry just means fixing Z1 to be e to the I times 1 over 2 square root of Ct, and all other Zs to 0. So this solution has charge, which goes like V squared, and energy, which goes like V squared, just like we had before. And now if we fix all of the relative constants between them, what we find is that this ground state energy is equal to 1 over 2 square root of C times Q. Okay, so at leading orders is just exactly what we expect. We just have a linear relation in Q if we just take the classical two derivative action. And what we're interested in is this leading correction. So like we explained, the leading correction is just the Casimir energy. So what I do is I take this solution and I expand around the VEVs to leading order and fluctuations. And then I can compute the one loop correction of the energy. Let me write down what you find. So at leading order, we have this. And then you find some non-zero contribution. So this delta zero looks like this. For nf equals 2, so this is as a function of this Wilson coefficient C. For nf equals 2, it's always negative except for the point C equals 1, where it's just 0. While for larger nf, it's always negative. It's basically just shifted down from this nf equals 2 case. OK, so now we're very happy. So what we found is that without for supercharges, there are non-zero corrections to this exactly linear case. So the most generic case should be some expansion in 1 over q around this linear solution. Let me explain this point. So it looks like this delta zero is always negative except for this point. It turns out that this point just corresponds to a free theory. So nf equals 2 and this Wilson coefficient c equals 1 is a free theory. This isn't hard to see. The reason this happens is that at nf equals 2, we have a CP1 model, which is just a two-sphere. And the dilaton is just free field, R. And together, both of these give you R3 if you're exactly at the C equals 1 point. So you just get a free theory, and that's why this correction vanishes. So it's not just that this delta 0 is non-zero generically. Delta 0 turns out to be negative, except for free theories. OK, let me do one more example. So I'm going to do a simple Wassermann model, which means I have no gauge fields. So I have a real superfield A and complex superfields x, y. I'm still doing 3d n equals 1. And the superpotential is A times x squared minus y squared. OK, so using the same arguments we've been using over and over, there is an exact moduli space here. One branch is where A is non-zero and x and y are 0. And another branch is A is 0 and x squared equals y squared. So I'm going to be focusing on this branch because it has broken symmetries on it. So the symmetries here are a U1 that rotates x and a U1 that rotates y. And both of these symmetries are broken on this branch of the moduli space. So we can compute, in general, delta min of both qx and qy. In general, you can do this. I'm just going to focus on the case where qx equals qy for simplicity. So this is like looking at operators which have the form xy to the q. So I'm going to compute the dimensions of these types of operators. So in this case, what I want to do is actually compute the coefficients here. So the coefficient here, I could not compute it exactly because it depended on some Wilson coefficient that I couldn't fix just from symmetries. Right, so that was this relative coefficient between the two terms in the effective action, this number here. In this case, I actually want to get a number. So what we'd like to do is perturbation theory in some small parameter. What people usually do in three dimensions when you want perturbation theory is to use the epsilon expansion. So I would start in 4D and then set D equals 4 minus epsilon and eventually set epsilon to 1. And the coefficient here, let's call it G. Usually you'll find a fixed point where G squared goes like epsilon, so it's weakly coupled near four dimensions. And then eventually we set epsilon to 1 and we trust whatever the result is. However, it turns out that there is an obstruction to studying 3D n equals 1 theories in the epsilon expansion. So obstruction to 3D n equals 1 in epsilon expansion. It's really simple. The problem is that in 3D, we have a theory with two supercharges, while in 4D, the minimal number of supercharges we can have is 4. So if I start with some 4D theory with 4 supercharges, what I'll actually end up getting in the epsilon expansion is 4 supercharges in 3D, which is 3D n equals 2. This is not what I want. So it's not immediately clear what I need to start with here in order to get 2 supercharges in 3D. Equivalently, you can say that 3D theories have Majorana fermions. 3D theories have Majorana fermions with 2 degrees of freedom, while the minimal representation in 4D is a Majorana fermion with 4 degrees of freedom. And so we have the same problem. There's no 4D theory we can solve with to end up with 2 degrees of freedom in 3 dimensions. However, there turns out to be a nice trick that lets you get around this problem. So this is due to Klebanov, Fay, Polsky, Giombi. The trick is that I start in 4 dimensions with a general NF number of fermions. So the number of fermions, I'm just going to call it NF. I do epsilon expansion for general NF, forgetting about supersymmetry. And then eventually, I set NF to be 1/2. So when I compute the beta functions, anomalous dimensions, and so on, they are analytic functions of NF. And so they don't know that NF should be integer. And so at the end, I can set NF equals 1/2. And naively, this gives me half the numbers of degrees of freedom I started off with. And so I should be able to get this Majorana fermion in 3 dimensions. And it just turns out that when you compare it to Bootstrap or to other methods, this method just does give you the correct result that you expect in 3 dimensions. So it's very ad hoc, but OK. It just turns out to give you the correct results. So you can.
How do you
I'm working on that. I don't have a good answer for that. I'm not doing vector multiplets, though, for now. I don't think there's a good way to do it for vector multiplets. Good. So now we can do this epsilon expansion for this theory. There is one more technical issue, which is that the epsilon expansion alone isn't enough. So what we're interested in is this delta min of q as q goes to infinity. And this just might not commute with the limit epsilon goes to 0, which is what we're computing things in. And you can very clearly show that it doesn't immediately commute. So instead, you have to do a neat double skating limit. So you work in the limit epsilon goes to 0, but you have to fix epsilon times q. So this type of double scaling limit was worked out in this nice paper by Rattazzi, Lomo, Onin, and Adele. And what they find is that you can systematically do an expansion in epsilon with this fixed epsilon q, and it takes the following form. 1 over epsilon times some function of epsilon q plus epsilon to the 0 times some other function of epsilon q, and so on. And they tell you how to compute each one of these functions in some saddle point approximation at large charge. Good. So repeating all of this for this very simple theory, we can find delta min of q. What we find in this theory is the following. So we have 2 minus 11 epsilon over 12 plus some order epsilon squared correction times q plus a log q correction, which is minus 1 over 32 plus some order epsilon, and then what sublinear corrections in 1 over q. So again, this has exactly the form we're expecting. It's this linear term in q, which at least at small epsilon we can compute its coefficient, plus a non-zero log q term, which again turns out to be negative, at least at leading order in epsilon. Okay. So I want to discuss one more application of all of these ideas. And this is related to something called the charge convexity conjecture by Roni and Pablo. Okay, so this idea is very simple. In flat space, we have something called the weak gravity conjecture. So this is some idea constraining all EFTs that you can consistently couple to gravity. The idea is that if your EFT can be consistently coupled to gravity, then there has to exist some particle in your EFT such that its mass is smaller than its charge for any U1 gauge symmetry. So this is a very simple condition, and this is one of these swampland conjectures by now, but this weak gravity conjecture is much older than all that, and there's some arguments from black hole physics explaining why it should be true, and there's many, many, many examples where people have checked that it is indeed true. What we're going to be interested in is, assuming this thing is true, you can try to put it on ADS, the ADS weak gravity conjecture, and then ask, what does this tell you about the boundary CFT? So in an ideal world, if you could find the correct version of the ADS weak gravity conjecture, this should tell you some universal law that all CFTs have to obey. So there's a problem, which is that it's not clear how to put the weak gravity conjecture on ADS. There's many ways to do that. But these guys had one idea. And what they found was that their version of the ADS weak gravity conjecture gives you the following constraint on CFTs. There exists some number, Q0, which is of order 1, such that this delta min observable we've been looking at is convex. So N1 plus N2 Q0 is larger than delta min N1 Q0 plus delta min N2 Q0. So basically, this delta min has to behave like this and not like this. It has to be a convex function. OK, and then these guys sat down and did many, many examples. And in the 2 years after this was written down, people did many, many examples. But eventually, we found a counterexample. So there's a counterexample in this paper with Sataka. And so as written, this conjecture just isn't true for CFTs. However, many, many people did examples, and it's clear that at least for a generic CFT, this statement is true. It was very, very hard to find a CFT for which this was not the case. So some version of this statement should be a universal law for all CFTs. And the question is, what is the actual statement that should be correct? So the most naive thing to try would be to remove this statement. So what the counterexample did was just give a range of theories where you can take Q0 to be arbitrarily large as you tune some parameter. But if I remove this statement and just allow for this Q0 to be arbitrarily large, then so far there's no known counterexample. Now, the reason why in this original paper these guys even implemented this constraint that Q0 should be of order 1 was that if I don't have this constraint, then I can just use the arguments from the large charge expansion, and this seems completely trivial. So just to remind you, at large charge, we know that there's two types of behaviors. One was delta min goes like Q to the d over d minus 1, which is always just manifestly convex. And the second one was an exactly linear behavior, which obeys this equality just with inequality and not inequality. So for large enough Q, the conjecture seemed completely obvious. But now from today, we know that there's actually a new type of behavior, or a new phase at large charge, which is that this delta min is linear at first order, but then there's corrections. So let's say Q to the 0 plus 1 over Q. So now even this version of the conjecture is non-trivial. Basically, what it tells you is that the coefficient of this term has to obey some inequality. This term just immediately obeys a conjecture, but it obeys it with inequality. And so if this term has the wrong sign, it could make the conjecture not true. So now we can ask, in the examples we have, in these 3D n equals 1 examples, is the weak version of this conjecture true? Is this true? Right. The argument is for all CFTs. In principle, yeah, you should only constrain yourself to holographic CFTs. But it just turns out that this very specific thing, if you put it together with large charge, it's just something very natural to expect.
But the other one where it was more constraining and
right. But no, it was not holographic. The holographic examples aren't very interesting because they're all supersymmetric. And usually you only compute things for the R-symmetries, and then you just have this. It's all protected and nothing's interesting.
One of the questions I expect the gravity conjecture
to be true if it's not a holographic CFT. They do. Swamp-time people do. But we don't have any non-trivial examples, so it's not like I actually have anything to say. But the argument is that this thing should be true now, forgetting about holography, forgetting about gravity. This should just be true as a CFT statement. OK, so basically what this means is that the coefficient, let's call this coefficient C, of the subleading term has to be negative. So now we go through all of the examples we had, and it just turns out that this Casimir energy on the cylinder is always negative. So for some reason, it just looks like the theories are trying to make this function convex, at least even at arbitrarily large charge. We try to prove that the Casimir energy on the cylinder always has to be negative, and we couldn't do it in general. We can do it for some very specific cases. But it would be very interesting to try to prove that, indeed, this thing is always negative, so that at least this version of the conjecture is always obeyed, so that this is indeed true. So this would be the CFT version of the weak gravity conjecture. OK, let me summarize. So assuming some U1 symmetry that's broken on the moduli space, what we found is a constraint on CFT data. Delta min of Q has to be some linear term plus either Q to the 0 or log Q, depending on dimension, and then plus subleading corrections. We computed some of these coefficients as well, and we showed that they're non-zero. So this is really the correct expansion when you have a moduli space. There's many, many open questions. So I did not get to talk about the case where you don't assume a U1 symmetry. But even in that case, our results are less clear. Basically, what you have is some simple bootstrap equation that you can write down for a two-point function, which you expand in short short distance limit and large distance limit. And comparing these two, you can find some supertutor of some rules. But one case that we're interested in, we don't have a lot to say yet, is this 5D n equals 1 theorems. So this is some open question. So 5D n equals 1 is strange in that it has a Coulomb branch, so a moduli space parameterized by one real scalar. And surprisingly, this real scalar is not acted on by the R symmetry. So the dimension, let's call this phi, so the dimension of phi to the n, whatever this thing means, is not known. So this is a theory with a lot of supersymmetry, but still somehow it has a moduli space irregardless of R symmetries. And so you could ask, what is the behavior here? Is it n or is it n to the 5 over 4? So because there's no R symmetry, because there's no global symmetry acting on this, our analysis doesn't help discover this. But you could hope that supersymmetry still somehow allows you to compute these types of operators, whatever this thing means, and see even without a U1 symmetry if you can argue for some tower of states whenever you have a moduli space. So the goal would be to still somehow argue for a tower of operators, even if you don't have this nice behavior when you have a U1 symmetry like this. Okay, thank you. The coefficient here and exists. It and for any value there should be a moduli space just tells you that you have this expansion. It doesn't tell you what is the value of this coefficient.
I'm confused about this statement that you're supposed to get delta Q and delta Q equal to N delta Q.
Mm-hmm. So that's just only true for four supercharges and higher. So for 3D n equals one, there's non-zero coefficients for the entire supposedly for the entire series. We can show that this coefficient is non-zero for 3D n equals one.
But supernatures cosmology is dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that with scale. So I'm trying to understand. So this definition of the supernatural is a power of this then.
Yeah, you're trying to say that if I have some scale V, then the VEV will be V to the delta O, and this is some weird number?
I'm confused because the VEV will have both an R charge and scale.
Oh, there's no R charge, right? I'm doing 3D equals 1. Yes.
Both have a charge and scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having trouble with this equation. There's a special value called.
I mean, generally, what I would do is add a chemical potential to the charge, right? So now the VEV is some chemical potential to the charge and some scale to the dimension. What do you mean? Well, I mean, this is, I can do a spurious analysis now, right? What is the reason why you introduced the scale in the first place?
Does it mean that your special part is more complicated
than it exists? We know it's two-dimensional. Right? I have the dilaton, I have the Goldstone boson, so maybe that's why. Is that why you're?
I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for this. This is key, is it?
I'm assuming there's a U1 symmetry on the moduli space.
Makes sense. Any questions?